Blog Talk Radio.
Live from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson! Good evening, welcome to Rated LGBT Radio, and I am your host, Rob Watson. Today is a fairly significant day if you follow LGBT rights and equality. Today is National Coming Out Day, and where historically that has been a day where a lot of people have in mass decided that was the day to come out. Many people have used this day today to reminisce on their own coming out and its significance. This is also the eve of another very significant day, and that is a day that occurred 20 years ago. We woke up and the news was covering the horrible death of a young man that prior to this, most of us did not know. His name was Matthew Shepard. He was left to die on a fence in this bleak part of Wyoming. It looked cold, it looked dank, it looked isolated, and he looked very alone. Fence was as close to being a cross as you might want to find in modern times. The impact of that image and what happened to him just reverberated on American society. Many people were hit by what happened to him, both gay and straight alike. There are many people in the years afterwards who point to that point in history as the time that they became an ally of LGBTQ people, because seeing Matthew in the situation he was, so innocent and so beaten, made them realize the persecution that was happening across the board to many gay people. Tonight, we look back at those 20 years when that occurred to Matthew. And we do it in a very personal way. We're going to talk to two gentlemen, one of which, Jim Osborne, was actually a personal friend of Matthew's. So we're going to get Jim's perspective of the real Matthew Shepard, what he was like, what he was about, what his life was like, and what Jim's life has been like in the two decades since carrying on from Matthew's death and tragedy and the outpouring of feeling from across the globe. We are also going to talk to our regular on the show, Brody Levesque. Tonight, Brody is not just one of our producers and one of our panelists and one of our expert journalists. He happens to be a journalist who was on the scene in Laramie just days after this happened to cover this story. And I think it's fair to say that Brody has been covering this story ever since in a very personal and profound way. And so with that, I want to welcome Brody, as always, to the show. Brody, good evening.
Hey, good evening, Rob. Before we commence and we bring Jim on, today is National Coming Out Day, but today, 7 years ago, I lost a friend, and the LGBTQ community lost a real voice for them of advocacy. Dr. Franklin Camney passed away on this day in 2011. Dr. Camney is... people may or may not know throughout the movement, was a preeminent gay rights activist from the very early days. He was fired for being gay in the 1950s from his position as an astronomer at the U.S. Army's MAP service in Washington, D.C. because he was gay. And that set him on a course for a really amazing life of advocacy and activism on behalf of LGBTQI people everywhere. And Frank died at age 85. He had a full life. I used to have lunch with Frank periodically. He was my lunch partner. I would grab Frank, and we would go to the DuPont Italian Kitchen. And the thing about Frank was, is you could hear Frank six blocks away. He had this rather sonorous voice that you couldn't miss. But I miss him greatly. He was not only a pioneer and an icon, but he was a friend. Matthew Shepard will be interned tomorrow at 10 a.m. at the Washington National Cathedral after a service of thanksgiving and remembrance. And this is being done at the request of Dennis, Judy, and Logan Shepard. Friday, of course, is the 20th anniversary. I think it's really important, and I think it's significant that Matthew's final resting place is the Washington National Cathedral, not only because the Shepherds are Episcopalian and Matt still attended the church, and the Episcopal Church was very much a part of Matt's life, but also because of the fact that the Episcopal has been probably the most affirming from the early days on towards the LGBTQI community. As a matter of fact, the first openly gay ordained bishop was an Episcopal bishop, my good friend Gene Robinson. Gene will actually be officiating with the Dean of the National Cathedral and the Episcopal Bishop of Washington, the Right Reverend Marianne Egger Buds. So Matt will finally be put to rest in a private ceremony in the crypt. I just think that that is extremely fitting.
Yeah. Brody, can you?
It's just one of those things that, you know, I think is kind of important. Yes.
Yeah, no, absolutely important. Can you explain a little bit, though, about the internment itself? Because it seems to me that this is, a lot of people seeing this might be wondering why it sounds like Matthew hasn't been laid to rest for 20 years, which is not the case.
Well, it's true.
But,
it actually is. That is true. He has not been. Let me first read a statement from Judy Shepard. This is from Judy. We've given, and I want to thank, I'll give a shout out to Sarah Grossman at the Matthew Shepard Foundation, who's a young person that I actually mentor occasionally, and she forwarded the statement of Judy's to me. We've given much thought to Matt's final resting place, and we found the Washington National Cathedral is an ideal choice, as Matt loved the Episcopal Church and felt welcomed by his church in Wyoming. For the past 20 years, we've shared Matt's story with the world. It's reassuring to know now that he will rest in a sacred spot where folks come to reflect on creating a safer and a kinder world. And that was critically important to Matt, and Jim will definitely be able to articulate why that's so important. No, Matt was not laid to rest, and the decision was made early on not to, principally because of what we saw that day in Casper outside of St. Mark's at the funeral memorial service. It all goes to a larger overarching thing that has been part of the 20 years. And I think Jim and I will probably discuss that. And that directly has to do with his legacy. And with that, we'll turn it over to you and let's bring Jim on.
Well, wait, hold on. I got more questions before you start moving us on. The internment itself is, he is joining a set of luminaries, including Helen Keller and her teacher and I'm forgetting her last name right now. So this is not just some place that he's being laid to rest. This is a significant edifice that key people have the honor of being in, correct?
Well, that's true. I one of the things is, for better or for worse, and from the interviews I've done over the years with people like Jim, and Romy and some of the others that actually knew him. I think he's probably a little bit embarrassed by this, but he turned into an icon. And you've interviewed one of his friends who did that excellent, excellent film, Emmy Award-winning film. Matt Shepard is a friend of mine. And I think that, you know, there's two parts to the story. There's Matt, and then there's Matthew. And by putting Matthew into the cathedral, it makes, I think, more than just a statement. I think what it does is that it gives him the significance that I think he's owed from at least the perspective of being the person that truly, I think, galvanized an entire movement, particularly with allies. Not so much the gay movement itself as it did with the allies. I had a long discussion. I asked Judy one time, and, you know, what was it? Why was it her son Matt that suddenly became this icon? What was it? Judy looked right at me and she said it was the grandma factor. And I had to think about that for a minute. And she looked at me again, and it was like, come on, you're smart enough, buddy. You should figure this out. And then it dawned on me. For the first time, someone who was, you know, the kid next door, or, you know, someone's son or grandson, you know, the nephew, you know, the person playing baseball, you know, Matthew represented the all-American, the everybody, you know, and this was something that the grandmothers, you know, the grandma factor, took to heart. And I think that's another good reason for, you know, Matt being, you know, with 200 plus luminaries at the National Cathedral, is because every one of those people in their own way contributed to, you know, the American story and its uniqueness. And even though it was a horrible, horrible thing, the silver lining to that horrible story was that Matt's gift and legacy to the LGBTQI community and its allies wasn't necessarily his story so much as it was his mom, his father, and his brother. And, you right. know, I'm very fortunate that, you know, I've interviewed Judy numerous times over the years, and, you know, I have so much respect for her. And, you know, at this point, I'll just shut up. I'll let Jim go from there. But, yeah.
Well, don't shut up, but we are going to bring Jim on. but no, that was the point, that this is an iconic move, very fitting for the stature that Matthew Shepard has in the significance of America. With that, I do want to welcome Jim onto the show. Jim, good evening.
Good evening.
Welcome to Rated LGBT Radio. We're thrilled to have you on. Jim, can you take us back to when you first met Matt?
Yeah, I met Matt in the summer of 1998. I was the chair of the student organization. At the time, it was called the LGBTA. It's now known as Spectrum. And a mutual friend, Tina LaBrie, introduced Matt to me because he wanted to get involved with the student organization and start going to meetings. He wanted to get involved with our efforts on campus. And she introduced us. I saw Matt almost every day on campus. My job at the time was working as a student computer tech. So I was back and forth across campus and stopping by the union a lot to fill out paperwork and do the planning for Gay Awareness Week, which was going on the week that the week after Matt was attacked.
And what can you give us a sense of who Matt was? I mean, what do you reflect on him prior to the tragedy? If had that not happened and you thought back on Matt Shepard, how would you describe him?
you know, one of the things that, that frustrates me to this day is that I was just getting to know Matt. What stands out to me is has always been Matt's smile. When Matt smiled at you, and he smiled easily, it wasn't just his mouth that smiled at you. His whole his face would light up. His whole body seemed to smile at you. I remember him being very concerned with other people. You know, Matt was studying political science. He wanted to do something to make the world a better place. You know, we didn't know if Matt was going to go into the diplomatic service. You know, he wanted to join the Peace Corps. We didn't know exactly what form it would take, but, you know, it was pretty clear that Matt was going to do something involving human rights or human dignity in some way. I remember that we were talking about a mentorship program on campus for our members of the student group so that folks who'd been on campus for a year or two could take the newer kids under their wing and kind of show them the ropes, whether that had to do with coming out or being LGBTQ, or if it was just, you know, hey, the lady with the white hair in financial aid is really nice. So if you have to go talk to somebody in financial aid, go talk to her, you know, those sorts of things. And that one of the things they taught us in being a student leader and an officer of a student group was to start identifying your replacement from day one. So because with student orgs, they turn over so often. And that was somebody that I had kind of spotted, and just his enthusiasm and his maturity and way of thinking was made me think, you know, after I get done with Gay Awareness Week, I really need to sit down with Matt and kind of get to know him more in depth and talk to him about, you know, considering becoming an officer of the student group, because I think he'd be really good at it. And, you know, to this day, that's one of my biggest regrets about Matt, is that I didn't take more time rather than just talking to him for a couple of minutes as I zipped across campus. I really wish I would have sat down and had the long, drawn-out conversations that he often had with folks.
Yeah, no, it's that speaks to so many people in our lives, how we need to take advantage of every opportunity. So, Jim, describe that day, the day that you heard what was happening with him, what had happened and what was happening. Where were you and how did that play out for you?
I actually heard about it a little bit before the news broke in the media. Thursday morning I went into work and I had an email from Tina Labrie and her husband at the time, Phil. She told me that Matt had been attacked, that based on his injuries, they thought maybe it involved a baseball bat because of the severity, that the police were investigating, that they didn't, you know, they knew where Matt had been Tuesday afternoon, but they didn't know what else had happened. And then I had a second email from her that she'd sent right away saying, you know, oops, please don't tell anyone about this. The police are worried about tipping their hand on the investigation. They don't want to do anything that would jeopardize the investigation and the outcomes that might come along. So please don't share that information with anybody. And I realized instantly that I knew more. I had, you know, a piece to the puzzle that Matt had been with us at the student, at the LGBTA meeting that night on Tuesday. So I picked up the phone and called Tina, and Phil answered and said, oh, we really can't talk about it. And when I explained, he gave me the name of Dave O'Malley, who was commander of the detectives at for Laramie Police Department. I called Dave to tell him what I knew, and he gave me a couple of names, asked me if I recognized the name Aaron McKinney, and I said no. And he asked me if I recognized the name Russell Henderson, and I said, well, I do, but I don't know why. You know, working for IT at the time, I changed a lot of passwords and dealt with a lot of student computer issues. So the name was familiar, but I couldn't place it. And Dave gave me details about Matt's medical condition. He gave me a pretty candid description of Matt's injuries, and that you know, told me that the doctors didn't expect him to make it through the night. I then left my work to go continue bopping around campus, and I went to the Campus Activities Center in the Union to fill out some paperwork for Gay Awareness Week, and it was there that I put two and two together. I started talking with a friend of mine who worked in the office, and she mentioned that Chastity Paisley, who was Russell Henderson's girlfriend, and also an employee in the Campus Activity Center, that her aunt had called into work and said that Chas wouldn't be coming into work that day, that something was going on. And instantly my friend and I put two and two together and realized, I said, well, now, wait a minute, what's her boyfriend's name? And she said, Russ. So it was at that point that we kind of figured out that Chastity was somehow involved as well. And then as the day went on, you know, I communicated a little bit more with Dave O'Malley. And by the next morning, we had phone messages. You know, it was on the news that night, on local news, and starting to be picked up by some of the national affiliates on Thursday night. And by Friday morning, we had voicemail messages from Dateline NBC and Good Morning America, and it was very clear that national media was going to pick up the story, and that this was going to go viral before going viral was really a thing.
Right. In the old-fashioned way of going viral.
Yeah.
Brody, now you were a young reporter at the time, and at what point did you end up going to Laramie?
I'll pick up from Jim. I was working for Reuters at the time. We started getting notifications in from the Denver Bureau that the story was becoming significant that Saturday morning. And I believe, Jim, if I'm not mistaken, that was also the university's homecoming weekend, was it not?
The following week. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the following week was homecoming. So for some reason, that had propelled itself into the cycle. And so we knew that this was going to be kind of a thing. I'm a political reporter. I didn't, you know, think that much of it. Nobody realized at the time Denver was actually short-staffed. The crescendo kept building during that week. And then on the afternoon of the 11th, I got a phone call from New York from one of my bosses, and he's like, you need to head out to the airport. There'll be a will call ticket for you to pick up. You're going to be met by one of the Denver guys at TIA, and we need you to go to Fort Collins, a place called Poudre Valley Hospital. And I said, okay, well, what am I looking for? He said, that gay kid that got beat in Wyoming. Okay, he said, that's the hospital he's at. And we need someone out there to help out. So I grabbed a flight, and the Denver guy met me, and we drove up to Fort Collins where the hospital was. And at first, when I got there wasn't much going on. It was kind of bizarre because there was like 12 journalists and easily three or four camera crews, it wasn't just local crews. These were national crews. I saw it, you know, crews from, you know, all three of the big networks and CNN, the major cable network. And then in the early morning hours, and it was cold, I'm not going to lie to you, I'll never remember that. It was just, you know, you could see your breath fall to the ground cold. And the hospital spokesperson, Gary Kimsey, came out and told us that Matthew was gone. And he was really just, his voice was shaking. And the phrase that stuck out to me, in fact, I was looking in my reporter's notebook. I actually pulled that out for tonight's show, was a statement that he read from Dennis and Judy. And I'm paraphrasing, that Matthew came into this world prematurely and he left prematurely, but he made, you know, a considerable impact. And I remember very distinctly, you know, Gary's voice just shaking. And I think we were kind of shaken too, you know, keeping in mind that this was a very youngish looking person. I mean, he didn't look 21, you know, at all. And it was a horrific crime. I was chatting with a young reporter from the Casper paper, the Star Tribune, and he told me, you know, some of the things that he had been told by one of the detectives on the case, Jim, you may know, Rob DeBrie, from the sheriff's office, and you know, it was bad. And then I got to the phones and I called the story to the copy desk in New York, and the editor, ironically, who sent me, was in the bureau. And I, you know, after I filed, he said, well, we need you to go to Laramie. And so we rented a car for me in Fort Collins, and I went to Laramie. I don't remember exactly what point that I met Jim during that time period, because things are a little hazy now looking at it. And Jim is very much in my notes. And I think the context of our first meeting had to do with the student association and some of the other things that were going on. And then later on, Jim, you and Romy, and you can explain this as we get into it, the angel thing. But that's how I ended up in Laramie. And then I went right back to the trial.
Well, one thing I wanted to ask you about, Jim, too, because this got attention, obviously, from people who were shocked and appalled across the nation, across the world. Unfortunately, in big visibility things like this, and you observed it as being viral, which is very apt, and our viral things attract the attention of both sides, and as did this, and the Westboro Baptist Church descended upon Laramie to crash the situation, and you stood up to them. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, Uncle Freddy.
That's
how we referred to him.
Oh, my God, Jim. Oh, that's great. I forgot that one. Good going.
We started calling him Uncle Freddy just because it, you know, it was close to the nation. We liked it. Folks in the Westboro Baptist Church had been to Laramie before Matt's attack. They had protested on our campus when I was, I think, a freshman and at the risk of disclosing my age on a national show and something that will be recorded for posterity, in 1994. So he'd been to campus before. We'd seen him. We knew kind of what he was about and the sorts of things that he would say. Phelps and his group did show up for the funeral. I wasn't there. I had gone to Washington, D.C. with Kathy Renna from GLAAD, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, to speak at the National Vigil in D.C. And I was traveling back from DC. I'd come down with a cold because I hadn't been sleeping or eating or taking care of myself, and she made me stay. So we stuck around. I stuck around and was coming back. Didn't get to see Phelps and his group in person, but there was a group of folks who kind of surrounded them in the cold and the snow, trying to block out the signs with umbrellas and singing Amazing Grace at the funeral to try and drown him out. And it got fairly confrontational listening to Romaine and other folks who were there talk about it, with lots of shouting back and forth. And it really stuck with a lot of us that on the nightly news, instead of just seeing a story about Matt's funeral, here were these messages of hate and these signs being held by children saying Matt in hell and things like that. So when the trials were coming around, we had gotten a fax from Phelps and the Westboro folks saying that they were going to come back to Laramie for the trials. And Romaine called me up. We had known each other from speech and debate in Wyoming growing up. I had judged her at the state competition where she made herself memorable by asking if she could deliver her speech standing on top of a table so that we could see her. And we were talking. She called me up and said, "Oh, did you see that Phelps is going to be up there for the trials?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "Oh, somebody really ought to do something." And I said, "Yeah. You know, we'd kind of kicked around some ideas, and we had this one idea about angels and having great big angel wings to block out the signs." She said, "Oh man, that'd be so great. Somebody really ought to do that." Well, I gotta go. I've got to go work at the coffee shop. I've got a shift coming up. 2-3 hours later, she called me back, and Romaine said, "How many angels can you get, and who do we need to talk to about permits? We are going to do this." And that's how Angel Action was born. We pulled together 11 folks, some from Denver, some from Laramie, most of whom had never met Matt. And we got – she had been down at the coffee shop and talking to one of her friends about it, and he grabbed a napkin and started scribbling and sketched out the schematics for wings. And so they went, I've commented before that, like any good lesbian, Romaine went to the hardware store and bought some PVC pipe, and the boys went to, I don't know if it was Bed Bath & Beyond or where, but they went and bought some bed sheet, and with a little bit of wire garland, the angels were born. It was just PVC pipe and bed sheet. And we got dressed in, we put on the wings and stuff in the basement of a shop downtown that Romaine's sister owned and operated at the time, called the Jaded Lair. And we'd wiggle our way out of the basement into the alley so that there was enough room for our wings. And then we walked from First Street down to the courthouse, which is on Fifth. And so we walked about four blocks. And often having to turn sideways so that our wings didn't hit street signs or lampposts. Stoplights were a lot of fun with a little parade of angels. We'd have to kind of wait and let the second group catch up. But we walked out in the cold, and as we came walking up to Uncle Freddie and his family, they had been shouting the most horrific, venomous things you can imagine. And as we walked up, for just a minute, they fell silent. And we knew in that instant that we had accomplished our goal, that we, the way I like to describe it is that if only for a minute, love silenced hate in Laramie.
Wow.
And it was difficult. I'm not going to lie. It was difficult to stand there and listen to the things that he shouted. He'd come up and shout things and say things directly to each one of us behind our backs. It was very cold. It was a difficult place to be and a difficult thing to take on, but we each had our happy thoughts, and something that would make us smile so that we could paste on our most angelic smile. And we each had a pair of earplugs in our pocket just in case it got to be too much. And I don't think a single one of us ended up using the earplugs. I think we all just stood there and took on the hate, because it was, you know, we wanted to be there to create a barrier so that people didn't have to, didn't feel the need to engage him, to shout back and forth. So that they didn't have to see the signs if they didn't want to, and to respond, not by sinking to his level, but by letting our silence speak volumes. Romaine read a press statement at the beginning of the protest, and then we stood there mm-hmm. silently.
Yeah.
We had law enforcement whispering to us under their breath when they thought nobody was looking. Good job. Thank you for being here. Keep it up. Because they didn't want Phelps and his group there any more than anybody else did. We had onlookers come up and thank us. We had people bring cups of coffee and hot chocolate. We didn't drink them. We just held them so that we didn't get frostbite.
it was cold. It was so cold.
Yeah.
It was so cold. And it was one
it was
of
so cold.
The most incredible things I've ever done in my life. It changed my life in ways that I can't begin to describe. And it was during that morning in front of the courthouse that I made a vow to Matt that I would, as long as people were still willing to listen and wanted to know, that I would carry his story, and that I would do my best to be a voice in honor of him, because he had been silenced far too early.
Yeah. I was with the LA Times reporter, and Jim, and when you guys were coming around the corner on the sidewalk, and we were in the lobby, and there was, you know, the usual gathering of us. So, and I, for the life of me, 20 years later, I can't remember his name. It was an LA Times guy. He says, "You're not going to effing believe this." Levesque, and he practically dragged me out the front, and we saw you guys come around, and it just, Jim's right, it went dead quiet. I think the two things that I remember exactly what Jim does, it was so bitterly cold. Oh, my God, it was cold. And I'm from Canada. I mean, it was worse than Ontario cold. And then it was just, yeah, I mean, you and Rome and them shut them up for like 2 or 3 minutes. And of course, they didn't stay quiet for very long. But it was just, that's a sight I will never, ever, ever forget, was you all coming up and taking the position and just, yeah, that was something else. Those are the things that really stand out to me too. I know you were in Washington with Kathy, during the funeral. I was actually at St. Mark's, and, besides Romaine, there was a few others. I talked to one lady who was later interviewed by, I think, one of the local television stations. Her name was Amber Miller, and she was using words like faggot and things like that. But the thing was, is she was more upset about what Phelps and the out-of-towners. There was also some guy, some preacher like Phelps from Texas that was there with his group of, you know, people, and he was, you know, they were all screaming about, you know, well, Jim, you know, it was the signs and the sodomites and the everything else. And the thing was, is we had just come from the press conference in front of the fountain area around the back by the rectory, and Judy's brother, Mr. Peck, had just, you know, asked us to respect, us meaning the media, to respect you know, the privacy and everything, and then going around to the front, and you know, behind, you know, they have them pinned in these like black snow fences. And like, I kid you not, they look like little pins, like at a rodeo or a stockyard. And the signs, the Matt in Hell and the Sodomite sign, but it was just the, you know, yeah. And then this lady Amber, you know, it got confrontational. And of course, the one thing I kept thinking to myself the whole time, and it's snowing and it's sleeting and it's cold and it's nasty, and I'm thinking to myself, these people are trying to have a funeral service for their son, and this is going on out the front. You know, it was just like, right. Really? I don't know.
Yeah. It's when Fred Phelps died, I had written a piece that was a eulogy for Fred Phelps. And you can imagine, you know, the points that I would have brought up in that piece. But the thing that I described, and Huffington Post picked this up, and Brody, I think you guys at LGBTQ Nation picked this up when I wrote it. And Huffington Post actually had me on and interviewed me about it. I became this de facto Fred Phelps expert, which I really never wanted to be, but that's what happens when you write. But, you know, it's like, whatever. But the point I made then was that, and why I'm bringing that up in relationship to this experience you both just described, was that the Westboro Baptist Church, their behavior with Matthew Shepard actually galvanized them as the opposite, the anti-icon, the hate icon, that many, many people who were not particularly pro-gay beforehand saw them, and they realized that they were the epitome of what they did not want to become. So in many ways, their actions made people think deeper about their own homophobia and question it. And they ended up having actually the opposite effect of what they intended to do. In other words, there were many, many, many more people who came to the realization that being gay was not anything much different than being straight, because they were sort of shocked into it by the Westboro behavior around, and as extreme as it was, especially in this situation. Jim,
I've
said
for years.
Go
ahead, Brody.
Well, Jim, go ahead. You first, because I got something to add to what he just said. Go ahead, Jim.
I was just going to say that, you know, I've said for years that Fred Phelps did more good for the LGBT community than I could do giving 100 speeches at public events, because for exactly that reason, that people realized that he was maybe 3 or 4 steps down the road from where they were, but that they had said things that were along the same lines, and that that really woke people up. And when we responded not with venom and vitriol, but when we took the high road and responded with peace, you know, we, at the same time on campus, when we moved down to the student union, when he moved down to the union, we followed. And we also, in addition to the Angels, we had organized an event called Parties Not Prejudice, where people who didn't want to see Phelps could go and listen to music and dance, and people had brought food. And of course, the DJ, who was a member of the United Multicultural Council, his name is Dominic Martinez, and was also part of the Latino and Hispanic student group, Mecha. He was blasting every Cher, Madonna, ABBA anthem that he could think of as loud as he could, so that Phelps had to listen to it along with us. You know, and in the years that followed, we organized, every time Phelps would come back, we would organize something similar, a peaceful, positive presence where people could make signs, you know, with 1 or 2 words that would respond to his messages. And Kathy Renna was just back in Laramie for some of the memorial events. And we did a panel as part of the Saturday University event, and it, she said something that, that kind of floored me because I had never really thought about it from that perspective, but she said that when we did the angels, that that really changed the way that our, that the GLBT community responded to Phelps and people like him. That rather than shouting, people started to get really creative. You know, we saw more people doing Phelps-a-thons or, you know, we'd done one called a hate-a-thon. So that for every minute that Phelps was there protesting someplace, people would donate money to a local GLBT charity so that the longer he stayed, the more good he did for us. You know, but just trying to find ways to respond that that didn't give in to the hate, that didn't perpetuate that cycle of verbal violence and hate speech.
Picking up on that,
that's,
you remember
ahead,
back in 2014 when Fred died, Washington Post columnist and my friend Steve Petro did a piece, a profile piece. And in the profile piece, I'm going to read you guys part of it because this is kind of, this is something that encapsulates what Jim just said and really what is Matthew's legacy. So writing in the Washington Post, Steve said this: Westboro Baptist first captured the public's eye in 98 when church members picketed the funeral of college student Matthew Shepard, who was beaten to death because he was gay. Many Americans who had never heard of Phelps were shocked and repelled at the sight of a church group at a funeral holding signs that read, "Bags are nature freaks, mad in hell." Oh, and of course, God hates fags. Still, when Shepard's mother, Judy Shepard, was asked about Phelps a few years ago, she astonished many when she told LGBTQ Nation's Brody Levesque, quote, "Oh, we love Freddie. If it wasn't for him, there would be no Matthew Shepard." I think she was saying that Phelps helped make her son a national symbol of the fight against that hate. You know,
absolutely.
I think in many ways, and you know, Judy floored me. I mean, she shocked even me with that. And then I later thought about it. And Jim, about the time that Michelle did the film, and I was, we were talking on Skype that afternoon, and, you know, we were talking back and forth about the impact of what Matthew's legacy really was. And, you know, here we sit 20 years out from, you know, that absolutely crappy week and a half in October of 1998, and yet there really was a lot of good that came out of it, because I think in many ways, and judging from what you've said, from what Romaine has told me, from what Judy has said to me, and a lot of other people have said to me, I think that had it not been Matt but someone else, and Matt was involved as much as you have been with what you did with Angel Action and your legacy at the University of Wyoming, and in the way that journalists like myself and my colleagues cover and do this now, that the real legacy here is exactly why Judy and Dennis put together the foundation 20 years ago. And it was more than just erase hate. I think it was just, you know, to make it so that people saw that LGBTQI people are just that, they're people. And that this artificial construct of hatred predicated on flawed interpretations of theology should not be something that we take them back and, you know, throw them right back at, but we show how ridiculous it is and how ludicrous it can become. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think the reactions of activists like you and some of the others are the reason that it kind of marginalized Westboro to the point where it is today, you know, and that is that, you know, it's a footnote to a story, and it's a sad footnote, but it's still that it's a footnote. And yet, ironically, it was, you know, that just the whole total tidal wave of rubbish that, you know, Shirley and Margie and their children and Fred and all of them spewed was taken and turned around, and it was like, no, we're not going to take this the way it is. The narrative of the story is okay, this, not that. I remember when you and Romaine, you guys told me about that year that Matt was in Denver, and he would drag people into the coffee shop off the street, the homeless people, and talk to them. And then later, when I was talking to Judy, she told me that that was just the way he was. He just had this natural innate sense about him of compassion and empathy for human beings, even the worst of them all. You know, and I think in many ways that's just kind of been his legacy. I don't know. That's just the way I look at it, Jim.
Yeah.
No, you're absolutely.
Yeah, and I love how, Jim, you kind of picked up that spirit yourself. I wanted to ask you, kind of moving us to today, your behavior with the Westboro Baptist Church and showing love instead of hate and not perpetuating what they were putting out. What lesson do you think we today in the kind of a progressive movement can take from that in dealing with Trump supporters and the hatred and the anger and everything that's happening right this minute?
You could not have handed me a better segue to where I was headed.
good.
I learned that from Matt. I've tongue in cheek said it before. I want to be Matt when I grow up. In that Matt had this incredible way of looking at people and seeing people first. The race, their religion, their sexual orientation, their political affiliations, all of that makes us special and unique. But it really is insignificant compared to what we have in common. And to see the human being first is something that I learned from Matt. And this April at the Shepherd Symposium, the Shepherd Symposium for Social Justice, which happens every year on the University of Wyoming campus, our closing speakers were Dennis and Judy. And the opening speaker this year was Megan Phelps Roper, one of Phelps's grandchildren, who has since left the church and is now traveling around talking about peace and love and responding to people as people. And that may sound awfully familiar, right? I actually got a chance to be there for the presentation and to speak up at the end and tell her, hey, I was one of the angels and I have protested your family on many occasions. And thank you for being here and for being vulnerable, for sharing your story and for being respectful enough to listen. One of the things that she talked about was that it wasn't the folks who yelled at her. It wasn't the folks who got in her face that changed her way of thinking. She was online and was responsible for a lot of the social media for the Phelps group, like Twitter. She ran their Twitter account for one. And it was people who responded out of love and treated her as a human being that really got her thinking about compassion. She said it was a rabbi of all people, and the Westboro folks, they're not too fond of the Jewish faith either. The gay people, the Jews, we're all just bad. But it was a rabbi reaching out to her out of love that really made a difference to her. And I think that for me, the message is the same thing that we said in the original Angel Action press release. Our focus is to bring forth a message of peace and love. Hatred is running rampant through our everyday lives, but as a group, we choose to lift ourselves above that hatred. We feel, as so many others do, that love and compassion for our community and our humanity are the answers that so many people are desperately searching for. We could no longer sit idly by and watch others bring forth messages that were nothing more than vindictive and hate-filled. We need to show the great nation that we live in that there doesn't need to be this kind of violence and hatred in our world, and that loving one another doesn't mean that we have to compromise our beliefs. It simply means that we choose to be compassionate and respectful of others. What really struck me this year was that here we are almost 20 years since we read this press release, since Romaine read this to the world, and it is still dead on accurate. It is still a necessary message. We're not going to get anywhere by continuing hatred and by shouting back and forth. We've got to find that common ground and those things that we do have in common. First and foremost, our humanity. And that to me is it's a hard lesson, and it's one I struggle with all the time, especially when dealing with people like Fred Phelps and dealing with the news coming out of the White House. It terrifies me. But by the same token, in the last week and a half, I have met so many incredible young people, and over the last 20 years, so many young people who are putting on the Laramie Project, who were in a cast and felt compelled to come to Laramie and to see things firsthand. Both kids are going to take over someday, and they're much better at this than we are. It's going to get solved. I just hope that it happens sooner rather than later. Because people are dying. Our rights are eroding. We got to fix something. So people need to get up and get involved and fight hate and vote.
Yeah, and vote. Jim, I unfortunately, we are out of time, and I'm going to let us leave on that last word and vote, because I think that is kind of the punchline right now, this time and place with midterms coming up. I want to thank you so much for everything that you have done. Particularly, and not last but not least, being on our show, but your work, your heart, your spirit, everything that you've put into it, just deep, deep respect. Brody, as always, thank you so much for everything you have done, particularly with this story, with your experience here, as well as your participation on the show tonight and ongoingly. I want to thank our listeners for listening in. We appreciate you very, very much. You will be able to hear us again here next week, same bat time, same bat channel. Also, listen to Out in Santa Cruz on www.ksco.com. That is 7 p.m. Pacific time and 10 p.m. Eastern time on Saturday nights. We will cover more LGBTQ issues. And with that, I would like to thank you again for listening to Rated LGBT Radio. We value you, and we will be back again next week.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio!